Watashiwa Jonasin desu. Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 357. I am your host, Jonathan Metz. I kind of already said that. And with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette.
Arigato something something.
And James Jones, the reason I was speaking my crappy Japanese at the beginning.
I'm not even going to indulge you.
Okay. John could not be with us this week, and we're sorry about that, but we do have a substitute on very short notice, Mr. Michael Cole.
What can I?
Wow.
I know. Yeah, so we are here to tell you all about Ace Attorney and maybe a couple of other games, but mostly Ace Attorney, and actually... Later in the show, we're going to be talking about some Halloween games and may or may not have time for emails. We're on a little bit of a truncated schedule this week because of Halloween. We're actually recording early. But anyway, we're going to kick off with new business. And actually, before we jump into the ocean of Ace Attorney, let's start off with Mr. Veillette because he's been playing a brand new Wii U game.
Yep. I got Wii U Party. As soon as it released, I had pre-ordered it because I'm just that kind of guy, I guess. The kind of guy who pre-orders Wii U Party.
Oh, you're that Wii Party, that one guy.
Yeah. Well,
is it Wii U Party or Wii Party U?
Sorry, yeah, I'm saying two different things here. Wii Party U. Yeah, that's this is
that sounds like a threat.
Yeah.
I don't know.
In Soviet Russia, Wii Party U.
Please be gentle. But yeah, like so. Okay, so this game, you know, I've talked about it on several episodes because I played it at E3 and I've revealed my deep dark secret in the past that yes, I enjoy Wii Party on the Wii more than I do Mario Party. And
there's nothing
I
to be ashamed about with that.
I gotta say, I'm not disappointed at all with the Wii Party U. It's really, really good. But I think, you know, like I don't know what frame of reference the listeners have, you know, like have they ever played Wii Party? I don't know. I guess the main thing is that yes, it's a collection of mini games, and yes, there are some board games that you can play Mario Party style, except that they're perhaps not as involved or not as well made. That's probably the weakest aspect of the game. But the Wii the mini games themselves are pretty solid in my opinion. Like the ratio of games that require skill and games that are just random and just require luck is a little bit better proportioned in my opinion.
That's good.
I think also I revealed in the last episode that I really, really, really love Miis. And so my enjoyment of Wii Party U really, a lot of it comes from that. Because, you know, Miis, as long as you put some time and effort into making your Miis look like you, like my girlfriend's Mii is pretty, the resemblance is pretty good. And of course I find it incredibly cute. And my Mii is exactly how I think I look like or I wish I looked like, with a full head of hair and a perpetual smirk that's just, you know, full of self-confidence. The Miis themselves, because they're so alike, they're already funny, but then Wii Party U puts you in all sorts of costumes and all sorts of weird situations multiply the different expressions, and it's just funny to see, you know, like these cartoon versions of the people, you know, just being silly. You know, everyone has a different sense of humor, but if you can find Miis and turtlenecks funny, you're on the right track. And if it's only funnier when they're, you know, furiously knitting a scarf. the mini games, perhaps like not super involved and perhaps not, you know, super imaginative, But there's a lot of comedy I find in them, and I think that's the aspect that I like most about Wii Party U.
I think that this might be the first game since Nintendo Land to really use the Miis very much. I mean, I think they're incorporated somehow in Game and Wario, but not that much, because that game's more about the, you know, the whole WarioWare character lineup.
Yeah, it's been a while since I played a game that used the Miis well or to any kind of extent, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I find them underused. And you could play as a Mii if you were doing the challenges and New Super Mario U and stuff like that, but it was really side stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird how they really tucked away the Mii feature in the Mario game so much, when that's how they originally showed that game off. I mean, that game was originally called New Super Mario Brothers Mii, and the only way to play it back at E3 2011, I guess, was with a Mii, you know, and I thought that was kind of interesting. It really made the game look a lot different, because now you've taken out the title character. And having your Mii, you know, it's a kind of game that I'd never really played as a Mii before. And I thought that was kind of cool that this is really, you know, very much a challenging action game. And yet I've got in this seemingly very casual kind of feature where I, you know, have this little avatar that sort of looks like me. And then I was kind of surprised that wasn't really an option in the final game, you know, at least for the main mode.
I don't think the stockholders would have approved.
I doubt it's that. I wonder if it had more to do with maybe collision detection or something like that. Maybe it was difficult to animate them in a way that looked right with the levels, you know.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so Wii Party U, just, you know, if people are more interested in the boards, there's that's really where the weakest point of the game, because the main board, I guess, the first one that you see is called Highway Rollers, and it's literally a zigzagging highway. It could not be more boring than that. And it's just when you fall on a square, it could be, you know, either it sends you back, it sends you forward, or you can be brought to the same square as someone else, or you can trigger a 2-versus-1 or 3-versus-1 minigame. So yeah, there's not a whole lot of complexity there, but at least the minigames themselves are usually pretty strong and pretty fun. Some of the other modes are a little bit more fun, though. There's one where I think it's called team building, and you're building a soccer team. But really, what you're doing is building a hand at poker. And so you compete in the minigames, and the better you do, the more you can pick from a pool of players and complete your hand to have a flush or a straight flush or whatever it is. So that's pretty interesting.
So this is more of like a mode that ties together a chain of mini games, but not using a board.
Yeah, because you've got, you know, like, you can go and play each mini game individually, but that is really not a good way to experience them. And it looks like even the developers didn't really think of that people would be doing that, because it's surprisingly ill thought out, you know, like, it's really hard to just, like, play the game again, you know, you have to go through a couple of menus before you can just play another round. And, there's even, you know, some of the mini games are asymmetrical. And let's say, like, I'm on the attack and the girlfriend's on the defensive. You know, we kept trying that same mini game over and over again, and we didn't switch sides. We would have to switch the Miis around, you know, like, we would have to go back into menus and make her player one. And I would have to be player two, and then we could switch sides. So it's really, you know, it's really poorly made that way, but at least, you know, like, there's board games, there's, you know, that game that I just described. There's also tournaments where you can decide, okay, well, the victor at, you know, the person who can win 4 out of 7 mini games will win. You've got different tournament modes.
If you do a tournament, can you choose which mini games are at each tier, or is that all random?
Yeah, that's usually mostly random. I haven't played the tournament because there's only 2 of us here, and I haven't had the chance to play with 4 people. But yeah, like, usually in all the modes, like, it's more either it's completely random, or the person who's in the back, who's trailing behind, can choose out of 1 out of 3 mini games.
It doesn't seem actually very useful for setting up a tournament.
Yeah, well, I haven't tried that mode. I'm sorry. I'm just saying, like, it exists.
Yeah. Yeah. But why bother? I mean, I don't understand that, but okay.
Eh.
It's like a Smash Brothers tournament mode where you can't choose your characters. It just seems really stupid.
Right. Anyway, I'm really enjoying the game, and I was coming back from work today, and the girlfriend was playing it by herself. So clearly she's enjoying it too. That kind of surprised me, you know, like these games, usually party games, you don't want to play it by yourself, or you're, you know, even when you're with just one other person, it's just like, okay, well, I win. Now you won. Now I win. Now we're bored.
Yeah. As someone who has reviewed at least two Mario Party games without really anyone to play them with, I do not recommend playing these kinds of games by yourself.
Right. Yeah. But there's, you know, there's not a ton of content here for a single player. You know, like, you can play against a computer at mini games, which is not really that satisfying. But there are maybe, you know, 5 or 6 mini games that are meant to be also playable for one player. And 2 of them are actually pretty good. Although it's so hard to talk about these collections of mini games, right? Because they're mini games. You can't go into details for all of them. And usually they're all shallow. Yeah. And so in this case, there's like a falling block puzzle game, which is actually pretty full featured with a 2-player versus mode, and you can play by yourself, and it's actually well done. You know, it's kind of a Puyo Puyo kind of thing where you match 4 and they disappear, and you know, like, it's pretty competent. I was actually kind of addicted to it, but because it's a mini game, I was getting really, really tired of the repetitive little music that was playing.
Yeah.
they don't count on people actually kind of marathoning these mini games. And there was another game which I've never owned Boom Blocks, but I really want to now, because it's exactly that. You have these structures of blocks that you're trying to make fall by aiming at them and shooting. So it's exactly like Boom Blocks, except without the motion. But there's maybe like 10 different structures. You know, you've explored it pretty completely, pretty quickly. So I was like, wow, this is really fun, but I, you know, I'd like something a little bit meatier.
Yeah, I have to say, Boom Blocks, both of the Boom Blocks games are better by far than any Mario Party that I've ever played. I haven't played Wii Party or this one, but, you know, they seem very similar. And, you know, I have to come back to the fact that I might actually be interested in playing this if it had online. But it's just, I don't feel like having to convince.
How long have we been saying that?
I know. I mean, it's 2013 for crying out loud. You know, I mean, Nintendo has to be the only company that would even fathom releasing a multiplayer party game like this without some kind of online support. I really don't understand
it.
I think it's so backwards. Did
Kinect Sports or Season 2 have online support?
I don't know,
no
James.
I mean, don't think they did.
I don't think that's a quality product in the first place, but,
But I mean, I think the point remains that I'm kind of, you know, I would expect that game to have it. I'm not defending its lack. I'm just offering a counterexample.
Yeah, sure. But at the same time, I do think a sports minigame collection is a little bit different than what we're dealing with here with Wii
Party.
Those
are barely sports games.
Well, okay. Fair enough. But yeah, but I mean, doesn't the Wii Sports HD update thing have online play?
Wait, no, it does.
It does.
Wii Sports HD, yeah. It's supposed to.
So, I mean,
yeah.
You know, if they can pull it off in Wii Sports, why not your brand new party game? You know, it really boggles the mind, and to me it limits the potential audience for this game so much that I think they're crazy. You know, I think it's really kind of stupid that we're still talking about this. I mean, we've been talking about, you know, taking Mario Party online since the GameCube days. So probably at least Mario Party 4. And
yeah,
they're up to 9 now, plus a couple of Wii Party games. And I just, you know, they're clearly very stubborn about it. But I think they're stubborn to their own detriment. And it's too bad.
Right. I just, you know, I'm not a big consumer of party games. There was like the first Raving Rabbids game, and there's now this. Like, these are the only two I own. And Mario Party 2 from Club Nintendo. So it's not, I don't have extensive experience with them. But this is pretty fun, and I'm planning to bring it, you know, like, at Christmas with, to the in-laws and things like
PAX
that.
PAX East.
Also, yeah. Yeah, that's going to be great fun. Let's move on. Unless you have more questions about
I do. Party. I do not. Yeah. Do you guys?
No.
No, okay. it sounds very similar to recent Mario Party games.
Yeah, but I don't actually enjoy Mario Party. I'm not sure exactly what it is. I think a big part of it is that I really do find Amiis more charming and funny. Like Mario and the gang, I'm not, you know, particularly in love with the characters, except when they're really, really well made and charming. Like in Paper Mario, the style was really great. And then, you know, like in most games that Mario is in, yeah, like they're pretty awesome. But then you've got Mario Party where the animation isn't right, you know, and they just like they move in really robotic ways, and their physics is all wrong because they all have to be the same, and Mario has to be the same as Wario, you know, like it's just, I can't. Whereas here, you know, the Miis all control the same, and that makes more sense. I don't know if that's all there is to it, like if it's just a psychological thing. But I do like Wii Party way more from what I've played.
That's fair. I wish I could be a little more curious about a new Wii U release, but they haven't done any of the things that would have made me actually kind of sit up and be really truly interested in this game.
I mean, it just feels like such a known quantity. The last time they did anything drastic with the Mario Party series, I played it at PAX East and just felt like I wanted to die.
I wasn't super impressed with 9 either, but I played very little of it, to be fair.
Oh,
yeah. Well, why don't we move on to something that you have plenty of interest in, James?
Had. Past tense.
Oh, you finished
it's
it?
Already done?
I have completed the game, yes.
Psycho.
Well, it's really no different than when I go on Leighton binges, is it?
No,
I guess not.
So, yeah, the game we're talking about, obviously, is Phoenix Wright Dual Destinies, which I made the mistake last week of numbering. It is not numbered because Capcom's fucking insane and has decided to just go complete. Just, I don't understand this company anymore. But it is the fifth Ace Attorney game, if you don't count Investigations. It came out on 3DS last week. It's download-only game, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Go get it if you don't have it already. Like I said, I've completed the game. These Johnny and TYP are also in the middle of playing it at this point. How far did you guys get?
I'm in the first day of court on the third episode, so I'm pretty far in. I'm probably about halfway through.
I'm at the end of the first chapter. Well, I should say I'm at the beginning of the second chapter.
Okay.
So the first chapter took me 2 sessions. It was roughly 2 hours long, I would say.
So yeah, you haven't done the investigation yet.
No.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's really worth talking about because it really is very similar to the previous Ace Attorney games, Miles Edgeworth notwithstanding. They've really like kind of made things a little bit more snappy.
They dialed especially in the investigation phase.
Well, yeah,
they dialed it way back, so you can't even investigate in places unless there's something there to find.
Mm-hmm, right,
and go there. And it's either the person you're supposed to talk to or your assistant.
Yeah.
If it's your assistant, just leave. Just keep going. And they're really good about telling you, hey, we should go here now.
Yeah.
As opposed to just like leaving you in the middle of the fun park.
Yeah, there are a lot of little things they've done. They've added kind of a notepad thing where it'll kind of tell you what you know, if you or your assistant say, oh, yeah, we really should go ask so-and-so about something, they'll keep it in a notepad. So you can look it up at any time.
I saw the notepad icon during the court case in Chapter 1, but didn't seem to do anything. I mean, you know.
It's mostly for investigations.
Yeah, it's for investigations. I mean, other things, like James said, you only need to do the pixel hunt type stuff when they tell you, okay, it's time to examine this area.
Right, and once you found everything, it tells you found everything.
Well, and there are other things, too. I mean, previously, you'd have to, like, poke at every pixel. You weren't sure if it was something you could tap on or anything. This time, they have a lot of visual cues. It'll tell you if, when you're hovering over the area, it'll say, oh, is this something you can click on yet? And, or this is something you haven't actually clicked on yet. So, it gets the guesswork out of it, you know. You don't have to just sort of tap everywhere.
You can click on this, and you haven't.
Yeah.
They also made it so the areas are more this is a little bit Edgeworthy. They've made the areas more three-dimensional, not just in the game is 3D, but you can move around a space and get different perspectives on it, which is good because that means they're not constrained for having to hide something in the back corner if they wanted to have something else in the front. They can just let you see it from different views and get the opportunity to experience whatever it is they're trying to show you, which means you're usually pretty tightly focused on the things they want you to find. There's not little things hidden way in the back that you have to tap to see it. There's a case, case 4 and case 5. There's a couple big areas that is tremendously useful, because if it had been the old style where you're stationary and have to find the things, I don't know how they would have been able to represent these items in the level.
Well, I mean, the other thing is you can go from anywhere to anywhere, from what I can tell. Maybe that changes, but you know, in the old games, there was kind of
It was more like Zork. Right.
Yeah, there was a branching tree thing where you kind of had to go to one spot in order to go to another spot. So it was maybe a little more realistic in that you're kind of traversing an area, but you kind of had to keep a mental map of the area you were exploring. Right. So
I think Investigations got rid of that. I think this carried over.
Maybe they did. I don't really remember.
Well, this sounds great. I mean, it really sounds like they tried to modernize that part of the game and try to make it less frustrating.
Oh, there were times where it was just like, what do you want me to find? What dumb thing do I need to tap on somewhere in this stupid theme park?
And
they also made the investigation space a lot more oriented around conversations. It's not as important about finding things. I mean, you still do it, but it's much more, you know, talk to this person, gain some insight. They may hand you a piece of evidence that's relevant, and then you go from that person to the next person and bounce the information you've collected across against this next suspicious character.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of that in the previous
games. There is,
too.
But it's the balance between that and finding evidence on your own has shifted.
Yeah.
So, much more heavily with the conversation stuff.
So, James, without spoiling anything, I do feel like there's a little bit of a bait and switch in this game. The first episode you play is Phoenix Wright, and then at least the two episodes after that I've played thus far, he is a very supporting character. So
yeah, in the second one, you do one of the assistants, and the third one, it's the other.
Yeah. Hmm.
In that continues, so it rotates back around. So I don't remember exactly who's in charge of case 4, and then case 5, it's sort of a rotating command.
Yeah, that's not dissimilar from other entries in the series. So
it's
a little disappointing that Phoenix isn't more prominent, but he's certainly more present than in 4.
Than in 4. Oh, definitely. He's very present in the 5th case and fairly present in the 4th.
Okay.
But yeah, the 5th case is really by platoon. They just keep rotating people in and out.
That's weird.
It is, but I understand what they're doing. They're trying to, you know, they're trying to make these characters almost like they're trying to make these characters freestanding. And like, do they have some
to
longer?
To what end, though? I mean,
I don't know. They made a whole spin-off series around one character. I mean, this is Capcom.
They did Apollo Justice, and it didn't do very well. And then they did Miles Edgeworth, and that didn't do very well. So,
it did well enough in Japan to make another one,
I guess. But I would have thought that this game would be their excuse to really bring back Phoenix Wright and reinstall him as the star of this franchise. And
He is the star of this game.
Yeah,
but he is not the overwhelming star of this game.
I guess I'm just surprised. Maybe it's just that he's in, you know, Marvel vs. Capcom 3. It feels like Phoenix Wright has taken on a larger cachet
own series. He has his own game coming out. Well, I mean, he's co-starring in it, but I mean, the Leighton versus Wright game, I mean, that's all him.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the assistants aren't in there. It's him and Maya, and that's it.
Okay, well, maybe that makes more sense then.
There is a lot. This game is very much a gift to hardcore fans of the series. There are a tremendous number of very, very obscure references to cases that may have happened, you know, 3 games ago.
Yeah,
Yeah, but I mean, it's in overdrive this time.
Well, I haven't played any of these since the first one.
But
I'll say at least through the first episode, I didn't have any trouble following it. I mean, the characters were, even the new characters are, you know, characters who were new to me. They felt familiar. They felt easy to understand. Their relationships with the other characters are spelled out very clearly. So it's not like it's difficult to get into this one. I think it's a very accessible entry point.
It is.
And because it is, you know, pretty clearly the best Ace Attorney game. I mean, I think that's, you know, hopefully that's becoming pretty obvious to people who are listening.
I disagree.
Yeah?
Well, it comes down to the story.
Yeah, to me, 3, because of its story, is still the best Ace Attorney game.
Okay. Well, I mean, in terms of playability and presentation, it's far above.
In terms of gameplay and presentation, yeah, it's the most streamlined.
It's also it's very impressive. You guys talked about this some already, but in terms of the graphics, you have to look really hard to tell it's not hand drawn.
They're stupid good.
Yeah.
It looks miles and away better than what Layton did just a year and a half earlier.
Yeah.
And it was, they're both attempting almost the exact same stunt. Mm-hmm. And it blew them out of the water in terms of just like character models, how faces express, how bodies animate, how the space is used by the characters, everything from scale, perspective.
Well,
the cinematic sweep of cameras. I mean, they really went all out on that.
You know, Capcom probably does have the most experience of any third-party 3DS developer, and their games have almost all been graphically impressive. Probably most notably the EX Troopers game in Japan, which has not been released anywhere else. But I mean, everything you hear about the game, the graphics are just stunning. And
they're amazing.
Probably the number one reason that people are really upset that Capcom has not announced any kind of international release for it. But I mean, if I'm going to any third party and saying I want you to make a really pretty 3DS game, it would be Capcom. And so I'm not that surprised, you know. And I think it does help that a lot of the backgrounds in this game are basically just kind of pre-rendered. So I clearly they can throw a lot of polygons at the characters and really focus on them, because that's really all that matters in most cases. And so they can devote all the resources to that, and it shows. I mean, they really did a nice job.
One thing that I noticed is I was sort of rounding third on the game, and I was just sort of playing with things to sort of enhance the experience a little bit. I was playing with the 3D slider a bit, and I noticed that they used it in a way I haven't seen a lot of. A lot of times, the game, you're facing a corner, and somebody's standing in the corner talking to you. Things like the fact that when you turn the slider all the way up, so it's full 3D, the walls actually sort of bend into the screen like they would if you're looking at a real corner. I don't think I've seen a game do that. Like, you can follow the edge of the walls as they go down in perspective. It's a lot of little things that they did that I don't think I've seen a game do that really made the 3D kind of work in ways I didn't expect it to. Characters seemed more round.
Yeah.
You know, it was a really, like, I'm really glad I used 3D, because otherwise, like, the game looks sad now when I go try to play without it.
Well, I can't use 3D all the time.
But. Yeah, I understand.
The anime scenes look fantastic in 3D also. I mean, we've seen that before in Fire Emblem, but it still looks really awesome here too.
Yeah. I mean, and they're well made, and visually, this is a very, very nicely done game. You know, obviously the music is what the music is. That's the series.
It's more Phoenix Wright music. That's right.
Yeah, it really is. It's not even more Phoenix Wright. It's more remixes of Phoenix Wright music. Yeah,
I do have to say, you got me a little overexcited last week when you talked about voice acting. Based on the first episode, there's not very much of it.
It really depends on how much video they throw at you in a case. In some cases, they throw at you more than others.
Okay.
I mean, it's never a ton, but it's, I mean, Phoenix didn't really have a voice before. There were three audio clips.
It's similar to like a Professor Layton game. Like, you might go an hour without really hearing anyone's voice, then you might hear it for 5 minutes.
Right. I mean, they were like audio clips from an intern for 4 games.
Yeah.
And now there's like real professional voice actors who actually gave these characters voices that are maybe not what you'd expect if you're just used to the objection.
Yeah, it's okay. I thought it was. I was a little worried that it would sound different from what I imagined. I thought the character voices are fine. They are.
I was a little surprised by them, but ultimately, I was okay with them.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, this is mechanically, it is a little bit of a simplification of the series. Having concluded it, I'm not a huge fan of the emotion stuff. I don't think it works well.
I'm not surprised, James. It kind of gets back to you're supposed to show how you feel, not say it when you're acting.
Right.
And the nature of this thing kind of forces you to say, I feel sad right now.
Yeah. In some cases, they explicitly go, I felt really sad. And like the happy thing's blinking, like, oh, fuck's sake. Or sometimes the thing is, all right, you have to go all the way to the end. There's at least one instance. I think there's two. And the answer is, nothing's weird. So you sit there, you like tap everything, and you're, because if you don't just page, if you get to the end and start paging backwards, you're like, what did I miss? You won't get that until you go through the end. Like, I guess nothing's wrong. And I'm like, game.
Well,
why?
I'm glad you said that, because that probably saved me and a lot of other people some frustration.
Just try it. Just if you get one, you're like, nothing seems weird here. Just blaze on through.
Okay.
And they may give you, they do get, so I will say the assistants give much better hints now than they used to as well. Sometimes they're a little too explicit, but some they're, I mean, sometimes they're like, hey, that third statement he said seems to really contradict the piece of evidence on the second page in slot number four, doesn't it? it's like, wow, I think maybe you're right. There's only one piece of evidence in the game where, that you use as an objection that I thought was a stretch, unlike most Phoenix Wright games where there's like four.
Right.
There's usually one where you're just like, you know what, game, whatever.
You know, I felt like there are a few places already where I felt like I was presenting the right thing and there would be a good reason for it. It wasn't what they were looking for. I mean, that always happens.
I get those.
That's kind of what I was trying to get at last episode when I was saying, well, you have to go through the hoops of the game, you know, before you can present the evidence that's actually going to do anything for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's there, but there usually is at least a couple times in the game where you're presented with a contradiction that you can see, but you don't necessarily know what piece of evidence fits it. You're like, I don't really have anything that goes there.
Well, and that's part of it, too. I mean, part of it's that you need to make the part of the conceit of the game. I don't know if it's really accurate or not in real life. No, I don't know what is in this game, but.
Right.
But more
than you'd expect.
You need to be able to prove relevancy. Is basically the concept here. So if you go right after something you know is a contradiction, but maybe it relies on a piece of evidence that hasn't been established as relevant to the case, you can't present that at that time.
And in fact, there are whole cases in the canon, not in this particular game, all about a piece of evidence that nobody can establish as being relevant.
Right.
I will say that, just as kind of an aside, I was reading an article that was coincided with this game's release. The series is more satirical than I initially gave it credit for, in that there is something along the lines of it. There really is something along the lines of like a 99% conviction rate in the Japanese court system.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Well, and the prosecutors can like detain people for a long time without.
Oh yeah,
a good case.
They interviewed a fairly prominent defense attorney who teaches, you know, law and is considered widely regarded one of the better attorneys in that field. And he's never won a case in his career.
Holy shit.
Like, the best he can do is he can negotiate down charges.
Wow.
Like, just because, well, there's two kinds of thoughts. The law enforcement says, well, it's because we only bring the best cases. The ones we know are open and shut. And then people who are in the defense industry say, no, it's because the court system's completely unfair.
So it's very unfair in Phoenix Wright. I mean, you know, in the first case, I ran into the thing where, you know, we've clearly established that the defendant, you know, my client, did not do this, but the judge has determined that we're going to spend the rest of the trial figuring out who did do it. So we're going to do the investigation as part of the trial. And if I make too many mistakes in the process of trying to prove who really did do it, he'll find my client guilty anyway, even though we very clearly established that she was not even there when the crime was committed.
Yeah, there is, depending on who you ask, a culture of guilty, not guilty until proven innocent, but guilty until someone else is proven guilty.
Yeah, that's, well, I mean, that's exactly the experience I had with Phoenix Wright.
So I don't know how accurate this is. I mean, there were a lot of first-hand interviews of people who work in the Japanese legal system, so I would assume it's a relatively accurate representation. But it sort of puts the series in a different perspective.
Yeah.
Like Capcom's being unusually satirical about this. Like, this is... I mean, given who it comes from, Shu Takumi, although he's not involved in this particular game.
I thought he was a consultant or something.
He may have consulted a little bit, but I didn't see his name in the credits.
Okay.
I was looking for it. It's not terribly surprising. I mean, cause he's a pretty smart dude, but yeah, it does kind of tint the game a little bit. Like sometimes they're just like, well, this seems really unfair. Like,
Well, I mean, Ghost Trick is satirical all over, all up and down. I guess I never saw Phoenix Wright as being quite that way, but it makes sense now that you put some context to it.
Yeah. I played the last case having read that article, and it really, I was like, whoa, geez, this is kind of fucked up.
Yeah.
Guys, this is really messed up.
That's
what are
why
we doing?
It's rated M.
Yeah, I was really surprised by that. I guess it's well, I mean, some pretty graphic.
There are unlike usually where they show like a body and they show like a silhouette of the shooting or something. There are bodies with knives buried in their chest, shown on full display.
Yeah.
And they don't. They're just, you know, they're just there. And I guess they figure because it's a digital game. It's, you know, it, I mean, it's a series. It's about murder. I mean, the plot of this game is five different people get murdered and you have to figure out how they got killed.
Sure.
I mean, it's kind of silly to paint over the blood because they're still dead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They still died in really gruesome and horrific ways. I mean, nobody just died from just having too much fun.
Yeah.
They died from, you know, having their stomach stabbed with a knife. I mean, it's not a great situation to be in.
It's a, I mean, we should say though, it's a very soft M, you know, it's really pretty borderline, I think you're right, James. I figure Capcom probably didn't try to fight it because they said, we're putting this on the eShop where there's virtually no barrier to anyone who wants to buy the game, buying it anyway. Nope. And so it's not really even much. I mean, you have to put in your birthday, but it's really not much of a hassle. For people who are buying it digitally. Whereas if you did that in the store, you might have some stores who say, well, we're not really going to stock it because we know we can't sell M-rated 3DS games. Or
right.
You know, maybe, you know, you have some people who are maybe, you know, a very mature 14-year-old who loves the Phoenix Wright games and has played all the other ones that were not rated M and has decided, I want to buy this one. And then they get really hassled at the store, which, you know, would be too bad in this case because I don't think this game is inappropriate for
anybody. This game easily passed for a T.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but yeah, I just think Capcom just didn't feel like it was worth the effort to fight it.
Right.
So the DLC, are you all, either of you seen it?
No, I didn't even know there was DLC.
Is it referring to the free DLC? So there's costumes you can download for free.
Yes, there are. They changed the costumes of the three main characters.
Hmm.
Phoenix just wears his old suit. Apollo dresses like a
punk.
Like I was trying to think of the worst, like a vagrant. And of course they put Athena in a sailor costume.
Yeah,
because of course, why wouldn't you do that? The DLC that comes, that's free for a limited time, by the way. If you really want to see Athena in a sailor costume, go ahead and download that now. The DLC that comes later, which is already out in Japan, is a sixth case.
Oh,
very good.
Which I'm curious if that's a one-time deal or if they built in the hooks to do as many cases as they want.
They're probably going to charge for that, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it costs money.
Yeah.
But probably
$5.
But if it's up to $6, it's really the going rate for the other cases because it's five cases and I paid $30 for it. I mean, if it's $6, whatever. It's just it's a pretty good deal. Mm-hmm. You could even argue up to $7. It's probably okay because the first case is what it is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm kind of looking forward to that now because that's all I've got to look forward to. Until somebody finally bothers to translate Investigations 2 so I can play that.
Well, now you can go hibernate.
James, don't overlook Layton versus Phoenix Wright. I mean, that's still coming.
Well, yeah, obviously, but that's a long ways away. That's that game isn't like that game doesn't even seem real. It just seems like something I made up when I was dreaming and everybody's like, I told somebody about it. They're like, no, that game really exists. Shh, don't tell him.
Well, so Mike, I know this is the main game that you've been playing over the past couple of weeks. Having plenty
of
experience.
Not like 6 days.
Okay. The past week. But having so much experience with the series and having played pretty much all the previous games, how do you feel about it? How does it fit in for you? Does it feel more of the same or do you think it's a nice jump forward?
Well, I think that in terms of the overall storytelling and the characters, it really is more of the same. Same characters come in. I feel like I'm playing with the B team kind of, but at the same time, I respect the decision not to rely heavily on characters that were already in three episodes or three games already.
Right.
So I get where they're going there. But from a mechanical standpoint, I think it's pretty solid. I really do like the streamlining of the investigation. I like the presentation a lot. The story seems solid. You know, I could poke holes at shit. I still can't get over the fact that the translation asserts, it continues to assert that it's not taking place in Japan, which I always bothers
me. It is increasingly becoming insane since the prosecutor himself is a samurai.
Yeah.
And actually addresses all the other attorneys as one would address a samurai.
Yeah. But I've had that complaint since maybe the second Phoenix.
I think it's the second game was the first game where they explicitly said it takes place in the U.S.
Yeah,
I think the first game they sort of danced around it.
Okay, but other than that, I mean, I'd say it's in the middle of the pack for the Ace Attorney games, including Miles Edgeworth. I'd say I like one and three more, but I think so far I like this one a lot more than two and four. And I don't know where Miles Edgeworth falls into it. I enjoyed that game.
But, yeah, it's a fun diversion.
So I think it's a solid entry. I'm really glad they released it and it wasn't half-assed, and I look forward to completing it. They got to be doing something right, because once again, yeah. I'm having trouble setting it down and going to sleep. which has been a trademark of all the entries in this series, really.
Well, for the second week in a row, James and now you as well, Mike, have made me really excited to play it as soon as we finish recording. So, for my own self, I'm very impressed with it. And, again, it's been a very long time for me since I played a Phoenix Wright game. So it's, you know, almost nostalgic at this point. I mean, I think I played the first one probably around like 2005 or something. So it's been a very long time, and I'm really, really enjoying it. You know, I think if I had played every single one of them, I would be really burned out by now, because I don't like this series as much as you guys do, clearly. You know, it's more like Pokemon, where I don't need to play every single one, but I do enjoy the formula. And I'm especially excited to go back to it when I can see that they clearly have done a lot to kind of modernize it and to, you know, polish it up for a new generation. And that gets me really excited. So, I'm very happy with it so far, but I need to play a lot more of it. Well, I will, go on next for new business. And, you know, mainly I've been playing, you know, Phoenix Wright, a little more Pokemon. I finished, Wind Waker, but there's not a whole lot to say about any of that. I did start The Last of Us, but, and I have to say, I'm pretty shocked at the vitriolic, reaction to John's impressions last year.
I thank you guys for discussing. Thank you. I'm serious. Cause both Uncharted 3 and The Last of Us have been on my bucket list of games to eventually get to for a while. And everything you said about both of those games tell me I should not play those games. I think
The Last of Us is far more interesting than Uncharted 3 was. I mean, Uncharted 3, but you know, part of my complaint about it was that it really doesn't do anything that hasn't already been done in Uncharted 2. And in fact, it's so formulaic that it really starts to feel kind of like a parody of itself. And it's not as much fun. Like, a lot of the gameplay stuff isn't as well balanced, and it's just not as breezy and entertaining as Uncharted 2 was. I don't even like it as much as the first one, quite frankly. So for me, Last of Us is much fresher. It is a different setting. It's different characters. It does take itself much more seriously. That could become tiresome eventually, but at least in the first couple hours, I'm still on board for it. And I'm still curious about, you know, what really is going on with this world, because there's still a lot they haven't really revealed to me yet, and they've built up a lot of tension, and I do like it so far. It's kind of a depressing setting for a game, and that could become a problem over the course of the entire thing. But for right now, I mean, I would say, you know, again, I'm very early in the game, but for me so far, I don't really see where John's coming from in terms of it being just kind of like another Uncharted. I would not agree with that right now, but I haven't played as much as he has. And I really especially have not played that many action scenes yet. It's been a lot of storytelling for me so far. So I'm curious to spend more time with it and see if I maybe come around to him. But I mean, the vast majority of the people who we heard from strongly disagreed with his assessment and felt that The Last of Us was, you know, very, very different. And, you know, a lot of those comments were very much based around the story and the setting, which are, you know, clearly what set it apart the most from Uncharted. And there are things that John didn't seem as interested in, or, you know, wasn't emphasizing nearly as much as he was the mechanics. So it may come down to just, you know, what part of the game do you find, you know, the most notable? And maybe that's kind of how you break on it. As far as I understand, he's still playing it. He's still enjoying it quite a bit. But I think he was a little surprised at the reaction, as I was. But the main thing I figured I would talk about this week is, PlayStation 4, because I pre-ordered one.
How are you feeling, John?
I don't know. I'm still really ambivalent about the whole thing.
It was a weird news day for the PS4.
Oh, you mean today?
Yeah.
Well, they released that big FAQ today, and I mean, you know, a lot of people yelling about DLNA. I don't even know what the fuck that is. I mean, none of the stuff people are mad about has any relevance to me.
It was just like, this is kind of a weird day.
Yeah, I guess so. you know, there's going to be more of those coming up. But I mean, the system comes out in like 2 weeks now. Wow. And, yeah, really. It happened about a week ago. They've been sold out for a long time, but I think probably because of the Watch Dogs delay and there was a bundle with that. And so, you know, a lot of people lost their pre-orders or they voluntarily canceled them, when right. that game was delayed. And so I think that maybe that freed up some launch units. I saw a tweet from our friend. I've never talked to the guy or met him, but Wario64, the infamous and notorious, gaff poster and Twitter user and, a conveyor of very good deals. if you're like a real bargain hunter, I think following Wario64 is probably a better bet than even Cheap Ass Gamer. I've learned about a lot of good deals from that guy. He mentioned on Twitter that, Amazon had gotten some knack, launch bundles for PS4, launch day, bundles. And I have relatively little interest in knack, but I figured, hey, you know, this might be the only way I ever get a system until like February or March, depending on how crazy the sales are, and how limited the supply is. And, by that time they'll be releasing in Japan. So it may not necessarily get better even in the spring. And I've been thinking about PS4 since E3, really. I mean, I kind of missed my chance during E3 to pre-order it right away. And by the time I really started to think seriously about it, it was kind of too late already. And I still wasn't sure if I wanted to or not. But then the flood happened. And that kind of tipped my hand a little bit because I no longer have a PS3. I mean, the only gaming console I have right now is a Wii U. I don't even have a gaming PC. I mean, I have my Surface Pro, which I can play, you know, some kind of 2D, maybe retro style Steam games and some, you know, it's fairly simple stuff. But I can't play, in any kind of like major multi-platform release. I can't play GTA 5 on my Surface Pro, you know, when the PC version comes out. Like I need a new console. I need a high powered console, and I could play that stuff on Wii U if it actually came out on Wii U, but that's not happening. So, I was like, I kind of want, you know, one of these other consoles. And I thought about buying a new PS3. I mean, right now I'm using my roommate's and I have all my games up there because he didn't really have an account. He didn't have anything on his. So I was like, hey, I'll fill up your system with my games. But I'm moving out here in a couple of months and I won't be living with him anymore. And so I may not have access to a PS3 after that. And I thought, you know, rather than replace my PS3, maybe I'll just get a PS4 instead. And, I'll have a Blu-ray player. Then I'll have a multi-platform game console. And, you know, I've still got PlayStation Plus. So I get a couple of free games that, you know, even if the launch lineup is not all that thrilling to me, there's stuff I want to play. I want to play Assassin's Creed 4, you know, and I could play it on the Wii U. I thought the Wii U version of the last game was fine, but, I've seen and played the PS4 version at E3 and it's crazy impressive. It's really, really, really beautiful. So, you know, that's clearly going to be the best version. And, so, you know, stuff like that really kind of tipped me. And, you know, when I saw the tweet that they were available, I was like, well, I need to make like a pinch decision here. Like these are probably going to sell out really fast, like maybe within minutes. And, if I'm really serious about this, I should do it now. And so I did it. I placed my order and like less than 5 minutes later, I saw another tweet from Wario64 saying they were gone. So, I mean, I definitely jumped on board when I had the chance and I guess now I'm fairly committed to it. And I am excited about it. I mean, PS4 is not like, you know, it's not the most excited I've ever been about a console. And I typically don't buy non-Nintendo systems at launch. In fact, I'm not sure that I ever have. But, this will be the first time, I guess. But, mainly because it does fill a vacuum right now in my gaming systems. And I'm looking forward to it. I think there'll be some cool stuff, you know, maybe not that much right off the bat, but definitely by next year, there'll be a lot of really cool content. And, so I'll get to talk about it on the show a little bit if people want to hear about that. The other, kind of piece of this is I also heard last week, this was after we recorded last week on Friday, I found out that, DualShock 4s were going on sale at GameStop a couple weeks ahead of the system launch. And,
why?
I think it's a really fantastic controller. I mean, I've played it. I got to use one at E3 and I loved it. Really impressed by it. And again, I actually have a need for a controller because, you know, I could plug it into my computer and use it on that. And then I was reading about it, and you can also use it on certain PS3 games, including The Last of Us. And so I thought, well, that's cool. I could use it now. And then when the system comes out, I'll have two controllers, and maybe that'll be useful. So I went out and bought the DualShock 4, and I got to play around that with that a little bit. And I still like it. I still think it's a really good controller.
I thought both the Xbox One, I hate that name, and the PS4, both their controls were quite comfortable from what little time I had at E3. And
they're
not that I
good.
Think Nintendo's are not comfortable, but it just felt like a lot of good ergonomic design went into both of those products.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think the Wii U Pro controller is, for the most part, a nice upgrade to the Classic. And I think it's a very good controller, but it's not as good as, you know, either of these new consoles have. And it's not nearly as supported, you know, because it's only usable in a fraction of the games that are on Wii U. So, and, you know, I don't currently have a Pro controller. I lost that in the flood, and I'm looking to replace it, but I'm not in a big hurry. There's nothing going on right now that I really need to have one, and I'm fine playing on the gamepad for most things. So, not too much to say about the DualShock 4. The capabilities of it are pretty limited right now because the PS3, you know, it doesn't support the wireless. It doesn't support the rumble. The same on PC, but I mean, it does have a really good D-pad, has really good joysticks, has really good triggers and buttons. And, you know, for the very few games that I've tried it out with so far, it has worked for most of them. And I think it works really well. So, I'm excited about that controller, and, I'm excited for the system. But
so PS3 supports using it, but only for some games?
Yeah, it's not really native support. I mean, it kind of works and it kind of doesn't. So like on The Last of Us, you can't use the home button. It doesn't do anything when you push the home button. So when you're done with the game, you just have to turn off the system. And it has to be.
Why did they bother?
Well, the thing is, they didn't really bother. I mean, they haven't really actively supported it. It just works. It just by the nature of whatever drivers that they have for it.
I would have just walled gardened it off, prevent that. You're like, nah.
No, I'm excited. I mean, that was part of the motivation, is I wanted to try it out on the PS3.
Oh my God. And it doesn't make any sense to release it weeks ahead of time, but it kind of work.
But I mean, if it didn't work on anything, I wouldn't have bought it. But I read about it, and there's a long list of the games that people are compiling of games that it does work for.
It's so weird.
And it works well, you know? I mean, other than a couple of little features like that aren't active yet. And I'm guessing they're going to go back and do a system update to more fully support it. But for right now, I mean, I can totally play The Last of Us with this controller. I mean, it's fully functional. It just
seems like a weird thing to just work.
Yeah,
and it seems like a weird thing to release your controller weeks before the system comes out.
It's the sort of thing that Nintendo will say, no, we're not supporting that if they have that kind of. I mean, that's probably why they don't support the bongos on the Wii. So there was some weird situation where it didn't work right, and so they said, no, we're just going to cut that feature all the way out. We don't want a user to have a weird experience.
The bongos totally work on the Wii if you play a GameCube game.
That's my
point.
It
supports them.
Well, yeah, because it's a GameCube at that point.
Yeah,
I mean it seems like the kind of thing the fake CEO Kasarai Twitter would have come up with. Except it's real.
It's kludgy, but it's a temporary thing. And I was just very
just
curious,
weird.
And I kind of wanted to try it out.
How did that happen?
I don't know, man.
You know, maybe because they do have those dev kit setups where. They are using a PS4 and what's really basically a computer using a PS4 controller. I mean, we saw that at E3.
Right.
You know, you're playing on a PS4 controller, and I guarantee you they don't have the final hardware under the hood at E3 there. So maybe it's just, you know, they're using some of the same drivers or something compatible just in part for that.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, I'm not complaining. I'm happy that I can plug it into my Surface Pro and play Rogue Legacy with it. And it totally works and it's fun. You know, it's a lot better than playing with a keyboard. So, you know, it's a big upgrade for me. And I really do like the controller, but, enough said about it. Okay. Well, we are going to wrap up this segment, take a little break. And, when we come back, we're going to talk about Halloween games.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week, we have a feature, Disney Infinity, Good Idea, Bad Idea, Halloween Town, and Hocus Pocus by Becky Aletta and Kimberly Keller. If you've not been following Good Idea, Bad Idea, the idea is simple. Becky and Kim brainstorm how the darkest depths of the Disney conglomerate can best be exploited by the misers running the Disney Infinity program. That's a words I've never said out loud before in here. As if they needed the help, and what quote-unquote fiscal opportunities, as the dev lead calls them, they should avoid. This time, it's about everyone's favorite Halloween-themed Disney Channel original movie, presumably.
I've never heard of it, so we're going to go with that.
I've never heard of Halloween Town either. But
it's fine.
That's actually a really fun feature. I would recommend that you check it out. Even if you don't have any interest in Disney Infinity, the feature is still pretty interesting.
Yeah. Isn't Halloween Town, Skeleton Jack or
whatever? No, different Halloween Town. Nope, different. Oh.
Okay.
There is disclaimer text very early in the article. No, I'm talking about a different one. Don't worry about it. It's fine. We also have a review this week of Professor Layton and the Azeron Legacy for 3DS by Don Koopman. Nintendo of Europe is bringing the love to 3DS this holiday season. Nintendo America is doing something else to 3DS. So while I suffer through the seasonal affect disorder known as Layton loss, Nintendo of America cares not. I don't know if Don cares, but I'll assume for the best. Oh, right, a Layton review. Don reviewed the latest Layton game, and it's a Layton game, which means I should write a joke here about what review score you can make out of 5 matchsticks.
That's supposedly the final Professor Layton game.
It is supposedly, well, it's the final Layton game. It doesn't mean it's a final game in the series.
Oh, maybe next time it's going to be Professor Luke.
I don't know, but they've been very explicitly saying the final Layton game.
All right. And finally this week, we have a guide about Super Mario 3D World by Andrew Brown. Andrew puts on his detective hat, looking deeply into 3D World's trailers and videos for tiny nuggets of information. Everything you could want to know is put on display here, all without the troubling process of having to watch 20 videos of Mario laughing as he brutally murders the so-called corrupted toads he derisively terms Goombas. Mario, hero or hater? Is this an investigative report?
No, I just added that part at the end because I was recently
piece.
I was recently reminded about what Goombas are, so I felt like I need a little punch.
All right, so definitely be able to check that out. The biggest release of the fall for Nintendo, and of course, as always, you can find all of this stuff. Probably some new reviews. Don't we have an Ace Attorney review, James?
We do have an Ace Attorney review. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So there's that, and much more over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week, we have a feature, Disney Infinity, Good Idea, Bad Idea, Halloween Town, and Hocus Pocus by Becky Aletta and Kimberly Keller. If you've not been following Good Idea, Bad Idea, the idea is simple. Becky and Kim brainstorm how the darkest depths of the Disney conglomerate can best be exploited by the misers running the Disney Infinity program. That's a words I've never said out loud before in here. As if they needed the help, and what quote-unquote fiscal opportunities, as the dev lead calls them, they should avoid. This time, it's about everyone's favorite Halloween-themed Disney Channel original movie, presumably.
I've never heard of it, so we're going to go with that.
I've never heard of Halloween Town either. But
it's fine.
That's actually a really fun feature. I would recommend that you check it out. Even if you don't have any interest in Disney Infinity, the feature is still pretty interesting.
Isn't Halloween Town Skeleton Jack or
whatever? No, different Halloween Town. Nope, different. Oh.
Okay.
There is disclaimer text very early in the article. No, I'm talking about a different one.
Okay. All right.
Don't worry about it. It's fine. We also have a review this week of Professor Layton and the Azeron Legacy for 3DS by Don Koopman. Nintendo of Europe is bringing the love to 3DS this holiday season. Nintendo America is doing something else to 3DS. So while I suffer through the seasonal affect disorder known as Layton loss, Nintendo of America cares not. I don't know if Don cares, but I'll assume the best. Oh, right, a Layton review. Don reviewed the latest Layton game, and it's a Layton game, which means I should write a joke here about what review score you can make out of 5 matchsticks.
That's the supposedly the final Professor Layton game.
It is supposedly, well, it's the final Layton game. It doesn't mean it's a final game in the series.
Oh, they maybe next time it's going to be Professor Luke.
I don't know, but they've been very explicitly saying the final Layton game.
All right. And finally this week, we have a guide about Super Mario 3D World by Andrew Brown. Andrew puts on his detective hat, looking deeply into 3D World's trailers and videos for tiny nuggets of information. Everything you could want to know is put on display here, all without the troubling process of having to watch 20 videos of Mario laughing as he brutally murders the so-called corrupted toads he derisively terms Goombas. Mario, hero or hater? Is this an investigative report?
No, I just added that part at the end because I was
mudslinging piece.
I was recently reminded about what Goombas are, so I felt like I need a little punch.
All right, so yeah, definitely be able to check that out. The biggest release of the fall for Nintendo. And, of course, as always, you can find all of this stuff, probably some new reviews. Don't we have an Ace Attorney review, James?
We do have an Ace Attorney review, yes.
Yeah, okay. So there's that and much more over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for a little feature on Halloween games, and unfortunately, TYP had to step out. He had an important website meeting to go to, so you know, we don't want to stand in his way of his important work on NWR. But we're gonna press on with the trio here of Guillaume and James and myself, and we're gonna talk about Halloween games. You know, we're recording this actually before Halloween. The episode will come out afterwards. We're sort of straddling the holiday a little bit. And I do feel like this is a holiday we've never really talked about very much on the show before. I kind of felt like doing something this year and, you know, kind of wanted to throw together something. So, I originally had the idea that maybe we could do kind of a last minute retroactive and pick a game for all of us to play, maybe something that we already all had. That we didn't really have time to come together and come to a consensus on that. So
yeah,
instead,
that was optimistic.
Yeah, I know. It was on very short notice.
I mean, we kind of already did a Halloween retroactive with Pandora's Tower. I mean, that game's too spooky.
That's fair. Yeah. I said, okay, well, why don't we just each, you know, pick out a game or two that we already have, just individually, and come talk about it. And maybe we can find some similarities or some themes or just, you know, kind of maybe speak about the larger idea of Halloween games. Cause I do think that's a thing. You know, maybe it's worth talking about. Maybe it's not, but at very least we will talk about some interesting Vidya games right here. And, actually, why don't we start with James? Cause I think James really went the extra mile on this, feature idea.
I went the extra mile in the wrong direction.
James has stared into the ill-defined face of true horror.
I have. So here are my choices going in. I have Cursed Mountain, which is a pile of excrement.
Some people like it.
Those people are idiots.
I think people like it conceptually because it's a Wii game that does kind of try to do something with motion control in a horror setting.
Right.
And the people admire that. I don't think anyone really thinks Cursed Mountain is a good game or that it's well made. But I think
because when you play it, you go, "This is a bad game. It is poorly made."
I think people like the idea of Cursed Mountain.
Yeah. So I have that, but I really had no desire to go back into that mess. I have access.
Why do you have that, James?
I got it in a collection of Wii games when I went on one of those. I'm gonna buy a bunch of these weird eclectic Wii games and see what's what essentially.
Okay.
It goes back to me curating the collection, as it were. I had access to, although I don't own, Ju-on the Grudge for Wii, which is billed as a haunted house simulator.
Yeah, I think that game actually is better than you would probably give it credit for if you take it on its own terms.
Yeah, like if you accept that this really isn't a game, this is a haunted house simulator. It's actually, I mean, I've played it before. It's actually kind of amusing, but like, yeah, if you try to play it as a game, it's garbage.
It's meant to be a multiplayer. It's meant to be a multiplayer experience where you kind of mess with your friends and make fun of them when they freak out about something that happens. I mean, it's not really a. It's not a survival horror game by any means. It's more of a guided adventure, you know, where you just kind of walk through this house and crazy things happen. I mean,
it's basically just crazy shit the game. I mean, it really is. And you sit there, or the non-game. I mean, they don't even call it a game. They call it a haunted house experience.
Right. I mean, I don't remember if you were with me, but I saw a demo of it at E3 the year that it came out, and the guys at Xseed who published it, they were very clear. This is not really a video game, and, you know, you're probably going in with the wrong mindset if you approach it like a Resident Evil or a Silent Hill. It's something different than that. It's more like maybe the Wii U panorama view things, except a little. It's more interactive, right? It's more interactive than that.
I'm just imagining Phantom Iwata jump out as you're going through Tokyo. She goes, ah! Wearing his stupid backpack with the camera on it.
Yeah.
But I decided I didn't want to do that because I was going to go the extra mile and get something that's semi-relevant based on its age. Which meant I went and bought Spirit Camera because I'm an idiot. Because I'm the biggest moron to ever be on the show. Spirit Camera, if you don't know what it is, it's not really a game either. I mean, it's really kind of the same vein. It's sort of like Ju-on with the story. You're basically, you have this book, that shows up at your house. It's like it's a notebook and it's full of really creepy pictures and text that they didn't bother translating to English. And it comes with the camera obscura, which, if you are familiar with the Fatal Frame series, is the camera used to see the supernatural and to essentially attack ghosts.
Okay, so it is explicitly tied into Fatal Frame.
It is a spinoff, yes.
Okay.
It was originally supposed to be a Fatal Frame game proper, but they decided that it was too far out. This is a Nintendo-published game, which means, if you couldn't figure this out, it's still $40 because Nintendo. But the idea is that you have this book, this notebook, that has all these things in it. And the story conceit is that the first page is blank, and if words show up and you read them, a phantom will come out of it, pull you into its world, and rip your face off. Oh. Rip your face off is the game's terms for it. Like, I'm not just saying that. Like, that's literally what the game says. Your face will be ripped from itself.
Is this rated M?
This is rated so M.
Really? A Nintendo published M-rated 3DS game.
No, it's not. It's T, and it doesn't make any sense that it's T because it's super fucking violent.
Really?
Yeah, it is. Oh, there's dead bodies and stuff. It's bad.
But... Oh wait, this isn't even 3DS though. It's DSi.
No, it is a 3DS game.
Oh, okay, there's another one that I'm thinking of that's DSi.
No, this is a explicitly 3DS retail game.
Okay.
And the book that it comes with is actually, although it just looks like a bunch of creepy pictures, is actually a bunch of AR cards.
Right.
So all these dumb creepy pictures in the book are really the AR markers for the game, which...
So did they have to figure out how to work in those, like, coin question blocks into the artwork?
No. I mean, you wouldn't think that's what they are, just looking at them. I mean, it's like, here's a picture of a girl who looks really lanky and gross and pale and a creepy house, and her face has been scribbled over by a marker because it's been ripped from her face! I mean, it's just stuff like that, and... I mean, it makes sense. You could key off anything if you wanted to.
Sure.
The thing about them is that the idea is that it's – you play the game. You stand up because you have to stand and play the game because the game is taking place all around you. If you're going back to the panorama view thing. As you turn around, the 3DS is aware of the fact you're moving, and you pan around the world. So think of like the Steel Diver AR stuff or Face Raider, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Only what's around you is a haunted house, and there's a ghost that's talking to you that you can only see when you're looking dead at her. And then there's other ghosts that are attacking you, and they're telling the story of how they got pulled into the book and had their face torn from its skull, essentially. It's super, super awesome. The thing is, what happens is the game will tell you, hey, like, the ghost that's your guide will essentially say, like, they'll be talking about whoever it is you just encountered, and they'll say, maybe he put his notes in the notebook. The notebook that she's told you not to read because your face is going to get ripped off. So you have to go in there and read it. And the thing is, you don't know what page to turn to, so you're flipping through the notebook and seeing what the camera, the AR functionality of the 3DS reacts to. And when you find the right thing, you center it up, and then on the screen, in the book, things will start to move. Like, the picture will morph into other stuff. You know, narrative will start to take place inside the book itself. Hmm. So, like, individual portions of the image will change, stuff like that. And that's really cool, and it worked reasonably well when I saw it at PAX East, two PAX Easts ago.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that you need to have a lot of good light for it to pick it up.
Yeah.
And by, I mean, a lot of good light, I mean you need to do this on the sun. Because I am in a room right now with a ceiling light, a lamp, and at the time I had the sort of dimming light of early evening, plus the light coming out of another room with all the lights on in it, and the light coming in from the hallway, and it could still barely read the book.
Right.
Sometimes. Mm. Like, so
this,
I could...
This doesn't seem like the kind of setting where you want to play a scary horror
game. It's not. It's not good. And the thing is,
you'd like to play those kinds of games with the lights off, probably.
Yeah, so, like, the thing is, seems totally unaware of where... of the cards. Now, the thing is, you don't know if you're looking at the wrong page in the notebook, because it doesn't tell you what page you need to be on, or if it just can't see the thing you're looking for.
Ooh.
It's... So, I am actually stuck. After about an hour of playing this game, I have gotten stuck.
Yeah,
I'm
because
not sure.
It's night now.
And, well, yeah, now that it's night, I really can't play the game.
It's like, yeah, it's like Boktai. I mean, you have to go outside during the day.
You kind of do. I mean, and the thing is, of course, the 3D on the 3DS screen flips out when you go outside in the sunlight.
Yeah.
So it's like there's the conditions under which this game is meant to be played literally existed for one weekend at PAX East 2012. That is it. That is the only time this game worked, as near
maybe,
as I can figure.
Maybe you could go to a hospital and pull it off there.
I don't know. Like, maybe if I could get like a plant light right over the book, but the whole rest of the room would be dark. Maybe that'd do it. I don't know. It's only for the period where it's playing the little video in the book and it's locking you into the next chapter, because then you're transported back to the haunted house. You lift up and you're panning back around, and that stuff works okay. You know, it's not great, but it's kind of a neat experience. I mean, you're literally walking through a haunted house. And, like, stuff's falling. You can look back and see what it was. You may hear noises. You quickly turn and, you know, maybe something moves a little bit. You're like, what was that? but the actual getting to those parts has become nigh impossible. And at night, it's probably certainly impossible. Like, I've been, during the show today, I've been sitting here, like, pointing it at it, trying to make it recognize, going through each page in the book, trying to figure out which one it wants. And I have no idea. And so I'm stuck, which sucks because, again... This game is $40 because Nintendo never cuts prices on their games.
Mm.
But I did this for you, the listener. So next time you want to write hate mail.
Thank you, James.
I'm going to take you out.
So, Guillaume, what did you play this past week to celebrate Halloween?
Well, I'm playing Castlevania 3, not really to celebrate Halloween, but more because my friends over at Negative World were doing a game club on it. I really like the first Castlevania. I think there's a lot of people who don't really like how slow it is or the physics, you know, like when you jump, you're locked into a certain distance and a certain, arc that you can't get out of, right? Like it's very, very,
it's
slow paced.
Stiff.
Yeah, it's stiff. But I found when I played it a couple of years ago that it might be stiff, but the game really is designed around those controls. I did not find the game unfair. Once you kind of, you have to memorize the levels a little bit and know where the bats are gonna come out of and things like that. But once you do, you are pretty much, you know, equipped to deal with the challenges ahead. So yeah, now I'm playing Castlevania 3, and it's just kind of a better and, you know, an improved version of that. The game looks better. It's got more details. You know, like the environments, the cemeteries, the Clockwork Tower, they're all, back, but more beautiful than before. And this time it's got a branching path, kind of scheme to it. Every time that you finish a level, usually you get a choice of going to the upper or lower paths, and you can have different outcomes. For instance, in the first branch, if you take the clock tower instead of going directly to level 3, it's kind of you're taking a detour, and you're going to fight a boss that's going to end up becoming a second character that you can control. And then you have to actually make your way back out of the clock tower. So you've been climbing this clock tower the whole time, and then stage 2-5 is you doing the same, but backwards. You're just climbing it down and trying to survive. So that's a pretty cool concept. And of course, like, it was the first time that you could control different characters in the Castlevania game. And so the first character that you can acquire this way is, Grant, this kind of, small, very agile man. And, he can actually cling to ceilings and walls. So there are some opportunities to downright skip some parts of a level. And, But it's really hard to do. It's really hard to control. And then you've got Sifa, which is really Silva. Anyway, she comes back later on in Castlevania canon. But in this game,
yes, and changes called gender, I believe.
Yeah, like in this game,
she gets
game,
a sex change later on.
Yeah, or maybe there's a revelation. Yeah, I wasn't sure what was up with that, but Sifa is.
It comes down to a mistranslation, actually.
Probably. I'm not surprised. And, this character, he or she has, powerful spells that you can use, but takes more damage, I think. And, really, you know, in most situations, you want to be Belmont. But, you know, from every now and again, you want to take control of one of these secondary characters who can actually help you through different parts that are more difficult to get through as a Belmont.
Well, I mean, the coolest one is Alucard, but you get him later in the game.
Right, I'm not there yet. I'm only at chapter 4, maybe. I've been making my way very slowly through the game. I'm finding it quite challenging. I'm not really as driven to finish it as I was finishing the first one. You know, like, the first one was a personal challenge. Like, this game has been taunting me my whole childhood. Now I can finally beat it, now that I'm a grown-ass man. But Castlevania 3 is, you know, I don't have that history with the game, so I, you know. But it's a good game. I would say it's my favorite of the series is Rondo of Blood. And I think my second favorite would be the first Castlevania on the NES. But this would be a close third. And I don't know why I didn't start playing this instead of getting freaking Castlevania the Adventure. It's just, that was such a wrong move.
Yep. I don't understand it either. Yeah. Well, we're going to come back to Castlevania. Actually, for my games, I didn't really have time to jump in very deep into any one particular thing, but I did play, maybe an hour of Castlevania the Adventure Rebirth. Which a little bit inspired. I've been thinking about it after you talked about Castlevania the Adventure a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
And we talked about how terrible it is. And it was very weird that Konami would make kind of a follow-up, you know, kind of spiritual successor to Castlevania the Adventure for WiiWare. And, you know, but at the same time, I thought, you know, it was actually really awesome that Konami made a brand new Castlevania game exclusive to WiiWare and sold it for $10. You know,
yeah,
I mean, this is a game that there aren't that many Castlevania games made anymore. You know, I mean, especially with the Mercury Steam 3D Castlevania games on consoles, you know, those only come out every 2 or 3 years. And, other than that, there really aren't that many. It's not a prolific series. And the idea that they made one exclusive to WiiWare of all platforms is really strange. And the fact that it's a follow-up to maybe the worst Castlevania game is even stranger. But I played it when it first came out on WiiWare, and I remember liking it quite a bit. But I hadn't played it in a long time, so I thought, you know, maybe I'll boot that up and kind of see how it jives with what Guillaume had talked about. And, you know, it really has very, very little to do with the Game Boy game that you mentioned.
Yeah, basically there are two similarities. The fully upgraded whip can shoot fireballs, and there are eyeballs all over the
place. That's right. Lots of rolling eyeballs. And that's about it. I mean, it doesn't even have the ropes that we mentioned. I mean, it has the stairs just as you would expect in a 2D Castlevania game. And they work the same way that you would expect. And, And, you know, it really is a pretty standard Castlevania game. It doesn't do a whole lot to differentiate itself. And, I don't think it's nearly one of the best games in the series, but it's also not bad at all. It's a completely serviceable, totally fine Castlevania game. And if you love 2D Castlevania games and you haven't played, Adventure Rebirth, you know, I think you got nothing to lose. I mean, it's $10 and it's a full length game. You know, really my only issue with it, which I probably talked about 4 years ago on the podcast when I first played it, is just that there's no save system. So you have to play through the whole game in one sitting. And
or do you?
Well,
there is a trick. I'm not going to look it up right now, but anyone can just look for Castlevania The Adventure Rebirth level select, and it's very easy. It's like hold a direction on the D-pad and select or something like that. And then you get the choice of starting at levels 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Well, you know, level select is not really the same because then you don't really have a continuous playthrough. I mean, that's good to know. But you do, though.
I mean, there are only 5 levels and you can start from any of them.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, fair enough. And I probably will go back and mess around with that. But, you know, it's too bad because, you know, I would have loved for them to put in a real legitimate, you know, sort of suspend feature or at least let you save at the end of the levels. But, you know, when you compare it to so many Castlevania games being available on Virtual Console, I think there are at least 5 others that are on Virtual Console, and they all have that suspend feature where you just hit the home button and it just saves wherever you are. You know, you said you're playing through Castlevania 3 very, very slowly. You can't do that with Rebirth. I mean, you can, I guess, play it one level at a time and then use the level select to jump back to where you were before. But, you know, you're not saving your score. You're not saving your lives. You're not really saving your progress. You're just kind of jumping back and forth, and that's kind of stupid. You know, I mean, it's a modern game. I know it's meant to be kind of retro, but it is a modern game. I mean, it was released in, I think, 2010, something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
Yeah, you know? I found that the level select screen, yeah, like it is a good point that doesn't save your score or anything like that. But I found that it did get the job done and it allowed me to finish the game.
Sure.
I didn't have any problem.
And that is the most important thing to me, ultimately. You know, I am just interested in seeing all the levels.
Yeah. If that code hadn't been there, I'd be way more angry at the game than I was.
Yeah. But I mean, I think Adventure Rebirth is pretty good. And if you love Castlevania, it's definitely worth checking out. But, you know, one thing we haven't, said about either of these games, you know, maybe, Spirit Camera has, you know, some legitimate opportunity to be at least creepy. It sounds like.
Yeah.
Castlevania is not scary whatsoever.
No, I've never.
It's kind of like the bad cover art from a metal album, circa 1985.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The games have mummies and Dracula and stuff like that, but the ghosts in Super Mario 3.
It's got a dude in a vest and a whip and and long flowing hair.
The ghosts in Super Mario 3 were scarier than this.
Yeah. I mean, Castlevania has always been really kitschy more than anything. I don't think it's more like Elvira, you know, it's not even trying to be scary, really.
Right.
It's just more of a nod to, sort of the culture of, you know, all those famous movie monsters. I mean, although I will say that, you know, even though I've never really, I mean, I think probably the scariest thing that ever happened to Castlevania was that Nintendo Power cover that they, you know, caught so much shit over back in the early days of the magazine. But I do think Castlevania is probably one of the ultimate Halloween games because it really is about all of those things that you associate with Halloween. You know, it's not really a haunted house so much as it is a tour through like classic Halloween movie monsters. And you know, horror novels.
And yet not one single clown.
Well, no, it's more classical than that. I mean, you know, as goofy as Castlevania can be, there is something sort of classical about it. You know, it's not interested in modern, ideas of, you know, what might be a scary monster or anything like that. And it really is very much interested in the classic, you know, Frankenstein and the werewolf and the mummy and, you know, vampires and giant bats and things like that. And I really respect that, you know, I mean, it is very much based on kind of classic Hollywood ideas of what might be, you know, considered scary monsters. And, you know, I think it's very, very much inspired by Bram Stoker. I mean, it's stuff that people would have considered to be very scary maybe 100 years ago or 75 years ago.
Well, the whole homage to old horror movies like The Mummy and the Wolfman and things like that is very overt. I mean, at the end of the first Castlevania game, in the credits, you get all these, you know, like Vlad Stoker or like, I can't remember, but you know, they're false credits with the names of various, you know, like actors and things like that, you know, Vincent Price and those people. And at the beginning of Castlevania 3, you get these kind of on the sides during the first cutscene when they explain to you the story, you get these kind of movie reel holes.
Yeah.
So it's very much an overt homage to those movies.
So you know, again, I don't think Castlevania is ever really scary. I think it's a great game to play around Halloween because it will remind you of so many different aspects of the holiday. And you know, another game that really explores it in a completely different way. I did not play it this year. I've been seeing a lot about it because they just released it on iPhone and iPad, I guess. But Costume Quest is probably my single favorite Halloween game because it is literally about Halloween. It's about kids trick-or-treating and dressing up in costumes and going around and solving mysteries and fighting monsters. And it's fantastic. It's really, really fun. I don't know how the iOS version is, but and I think what's great about Costume Quest is that it takes place in the real world more or less. I mean, you know, these kids are playing make believe, and so there's a kind of a Calvin and Hobbes aspect where they, you know, when they get into a battle, you see like what their costume is supposed to be, right? So it doesn't look like a little kid dressed up. It looks like a real, you know, Japanese samurai robot, or it looks like a real vampire. And then when you're running around in the world, it just looks like kids dressed up, and it's really cute.
Yeah, like you see in the real world, it's just a kid in an oil drum and with a pair of rollerblades or whatever, an extremely crappy costume. But then during the fight scenes, it's actually, you know, like Megazord or whatever it is.
It's a fantastic idea. I would love for them to expand on that and do even more with it. But
they did an add-on, right?
There's a DLC. It's not as good, and it's pretty short. But, the DLC actually, one thing it kind of disappoints me about it is that it takes place essentially in the winter. I think they go through some dimensional gate or some bullshit like that. But it takes place in like this snowy area, and it took away the one thing that I love the most about Costume Quest, which is not even that it's about Halloween, but that it is set in autumn. And that is a setting that I've just never really seen before in video games. I mean, it's so incredibly charming. You're running around these neighborhood streets, and the leaves are all turning brown and gold and red. And there's just really a feeling of fall. You know, it's almost like a Spielberg kind of atmosphere.
I mean, what's funny is movies often set in fall because it's presentationally conducive to it. There's decent lighting and
it's also very
scenery.
I think there's also something nostalgic about setting a movie in the fall.
There's certainly an emotional component to the setting.
Right. And but you almost never see that in video games.
No, because video games, you very rarely see it's sunny or it's snowing. Yeah. I mean, there's no real artistic derivation in play there for them to play with to give sort of the setting of seasons. And that's probably because until relatively recently, they couldn't realistically do it.
Yeah, and you know, Costume Quest is a very simple presentation, so maybe it's, you know, relatively easier for them to show all the leaves and all the different colors and everything, just because it's not a lavish production, you know.
Right.
Anyway, I just want to throw that out there. If you've never played Costume Quest and if you really love Halloween, I think it's by far the best Halloween game I've ever played. It was literally about Halloween and trick-or-treating, and it's so much fun. The other game I wanted to bring up, this is really a stretch, and I freely admit that, but I thought it was kind of funny. And I really did play it last night, and I thought about it. I was trying to keep this feature in mind as I was playing through it, but I played the Transylvania level in DuckTales Remastered, which is...
Well, as a kid, it did scare me.
Did it really?
Well, I mean, aren't there unkillable ghosts? I think that's the thing. When there are enemies that you can't kill and that are coming after you, that's what scared me the most about about games as a kid. So Castlevania was nothing, right? You can kill everything, but the ghosts in Super Mario 3, that was always super tense because they're always coming at you in some way, right?
Or Phantos in Super Mario Brothers 2.
Just like my fans.
What? Like your Nothing. Fans?
That's a joke for the listeners.
Okay.
I don't get it.
It's fine.
Yeah, I played Transylvania in DuckTales. It's about a fifth of the game. I mean, it's a significant portion of the game, but, certainly the rest of the game is not really the same theme. But, this level in particular is very much, it's kind of a play on Castlevania, I think. It would have been around the time where, you probably could have legitimately done some kind of parody of, Castlevania. And, of course it's based, I think, on an episode of the cartoon. So you can't say it's entirely from Castlevania, but I'm sure the designers at Capcom had that in mind. And they were, they had some, they had their hands dirty in stuff like Ghosts and Goblins and, Gargoyle's Quest. So, I mean, they, Capcom had a history of doing sort of horror themed games in a sense, but, Transylvania, it is a little bit of a strange thing to put into a kid's game about a popular Saturday cartoon. Just because it is, it does take place in this haunted house. You've got these mysterious mirrors that warp you all over the place. So it's very disorienting. In this version, in the remastered version, you can pause and see a map. It actually looks exactly like a Metroid map, although it's not very complicated at all. And I think this is the only level that really has quite that detailed of a map. I don't recall seeing that on the other levels. But the map is very useful because of the warp points that you have to use. But the whole level takes place in this haunted mansion. Or it might be a castle, but it looks more like a mansion on the inside. And you've got ghosts flying around. There are mummies with balls and chains that they drag around them that you have to hit at them to destroy them. There are suits of armor all over the place that kind of contain. If you hit them with your cane, they may contain treasure, but they may contain a ghost. And if it's a ghost, you have very little time to get out of the way. So they're kind of a risk reward thing. And then the boss of the level is a Magicka Dispel, who is probably my favorite character from the cartoon just because she has this crazy accent. She's really, the way she talks is really funny. And, she's this witch who, shoots like lasers at you and columns of fire. And then she turns into a bird, that you, have to bop on top of. And, the level is maybe not super impressive by today's design standards, but at the time I always felt it was one of the most iconic pieces of DuckTales because it had this weird non-linear structure to it where you're warping around and you're looking for things and there are secret walls, secret passages through the walls, that sort of become apparent as you get right up next to the wall. So there's lots of secrets. It's a big part of the game. And again, I mean, there's nothing remotely scary about it, but there is kind of a neat place.
Like 8-year-old me disagrees. 8-year-old Guillaume just always saved Transylvania for the end.
Really? Really?
Maybe I shouldn't be saying this to
millions
of listeners.
I do not judge your 8-year-old self.
I judge him.
I don't remember being scared of it as a kid, but I do remember finding it kind of stressful because of the disorientation. And in the remastered version, I don't remember this in the original, but there's a section in the basement on the lowest floor of the map where it's really dark and you can only see in a little tight radius right around Scrooge as you play around. And it's very dark down there. It's pretty stressful to play through because you really cannot see very far in front of you at all. And there's no torches to activate or anything like that. I mean, you just have to play a little bit more cautiously. And there are, long stretches of spiked floors down there where you have to pogo across it. And, it's already a pretty challenging game. So, having a section like that where your visibility is so limited is, definitely, it ups the ante a little bit. So, I thought it was kind of a cute little addition to our Halloween feature, even though it's not a game that you would probably associate with Halloween typically. So, you know, now that we've all gotten a chance to talk about a couple of games, I kind of wanted to ask you guys just more on a general level. I mean, do you find games like this appealing? I mean, is Halloween a holiday that you associate with video gaming, and are there games that you typically like to play around Halloween, or that it reminds you of?
I mean, personally, I only have one real experience with this, which was Resident Evil 2 on the N64 when it came out. I don't know why I was playing on Halloween.
That video compression is pretty scary.
I think I was sick, and that was why I was playing it.
Or maybe you were sick because you were playing it.
I seem to recall I was sick, and one of my – and it must have been my mother, because she's been the one to do this. Being who she is, rented that game for me from Blockbuster because I was going to be in bed for like 4 days through Halloween. And I remember thinking, God, this is awful. Because Resident Evil, like the first three Resident Evil games, they're awful.
Yeah.
Tank controls are the worst things ever. And I remember...
They're not that bad.
No, they're bad. They're awful. They're really egregiously terrible. This was way... I'm walking right, and all of a sudden I'm walking left because the camera decided it's time to change. Yeah, they're terrible. But... And I remember thinking, wow, this game is... just abysmal. But like, that was my Halloween, was playing that stupid game. So for whatever reason, that game I associate with Halloween. I'm like, God, I hate Resident Evil. that's how that plays out. The only other example I have, I don't know if I played it on Halloween, but I played it around Halloween, was a second playthrough of Fragile Dreams, which can be a deeply unsettling game sometimes.
That really is a legitimately very creepy and it's moody. You know, that game is really atmospheric.
It can be very brooding, and then there are situations where stuff's happening around you in this dark area. You're not entirely sure what's going on, but you know you don't want to be any part of it. You want no part of what is going on right now. And you just need to get the hell out of there. And it can be very stressful to play.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you remember, I don't care for Fragile Dreams very much. In fact, for a lot of the same reasons you don't like Resident Evil. But I do respect it very much in terms of building that.
I definitively think Fragile Dreams is a functionally bad game. But from a presentation standpoint, it's so overwhelming that I can get an experience from playing it. I think it is
sure.
It is
and,
a
you know, that's
functionally...
how most people, I think, felt about... I think that's how most people felt about the early Resident Evil games as well. You know, they were willing to put up with some of that stuff because it was a setting.
Those games just seem so cheesy to me.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely are cheesy. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't get that feeling there. I just get this overwhelming sense of just brooding sadness, punctuated by moments of, oh God, it's one of those witches. I'm going to die. Oh God, I don't want to be here anymore. That's pretty much that game personified. I feel really sad. Like, you never feel good playing that game. You just feel sad, and then you hear the sound of a witch. You're like, no, please, no. I don't want to deal with these things again. These bastards are impossible. And I have to beat them with a broomstick. It's awful. Oh, yeah.
All right, so, Guillaume, what about you? I mean, what are kind of your general thoughts about Halloween gaming?
Yeah, it's not really something that I seek usually. I think I tried last year to play through the first Silent Hill, but I really didn't take to it at all. It's just, you know, it was just constantly shooting at like flying demons or something like that. And
have you played Shattered Memories on Wii?
No. That was the thinking I wanted in preparation for Silent Memories or Shadow. What did you call it? Shattered Memories.
Shattered Memories.
I wanted to play through the first game, but I don't think I ever can do that. It's just too dated, and I don't have an affinity for the type of gameplay. And like the puzzles were so obtuse, I didn't have the patience for it.
Yeah, I think people will still defend Silent Hill 2, maybe despite some mechanical issues, but I think a lot of people still, you know, are fans of Silent Hill 2. But I've never heard anyone really recommend the original Silent Hill over Shattered Memories, which is effectively a remake. It plays very differently than the first Silent Hill, but it tells more or less the same story.
Yeah.
And that's I think one of the best Wii games. I think it's really it would be a great Halloween game, actually.
Yeah, but the funny thing is I own Shattered Memories. I also own Silent Hill 2. And I own a couple of Resident Evil games, and none of those games are ever going to get played, I feel. Because every time, you know, I like the idea of playing, you know, scary games for Halloween. But then, at my job, it always happens to be one of the when a lot of work starts happening. So I have less time. But also, I keep putting off actually playing these games because I don't like being scared. So it's just, you know, and probably I would get into them if I actually started playing them more, but I don't even know why I bought them. But back in the day, I actually, you know, back when games could almost not be scary because they were too primitive, I did love Alone in the Dark, the first one. That was a pretty spooky game, you know, like it did the whole Cthulhu horror thing, ripoff better than Eternal Darkness did, or at least like way before.
They had to play with your head a lot more back then than they do now. Now it's jump scares and a situational lighting, whereas then they had to kind of make you start thinking in your own head, okay, this is spooky. Like, because there wasn't a lot of canvas to play on. I mean, really, until things like the pre-rendered CD-based game came into being, there wasn't a lot of options available to the game developer to visually make things startling.
Yeah, no. I mean, I remember Resident Evil was, you know, on PlayStation 1, probably the first time I ever heard of people being legitimately scared by a video game. I mean, before that, it wasn't really something that we were seeking, you know, it wasn't even something that I thought was possible that you could be scared by a video game.
You couldn't really do a jump scare on a Super Nintendo. Now, like Clock Tower, the original Super Nintendo Clock Tower, kind of has jump scares.
Which that just came out on Japanese Virtual Console.
Yeah. It has jump scares in that he pops up when you open a door and is like, sup? And you're like, he's here now. But it can't really do like dogs busting through a window because it's a dude who paces really slowly holding big scissors.
Yeah.
I mean, it is what it is. So, yeah, I mean, the jump scare really doesn't come into play until there's a 3D environment to sort of put it in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really had to play more on your fear of losing than anything else.
Yeah,
or your fear of whatever story they're trying to say. Like there were some old adventure games I played as a kid and stuff that it's kind of that adventure game visual novel hybrid, you know, heavy story emphasis adventure games that were scary just because of the story.
Yeah, what about Maniac Mansion? Is that a Halloween game?
It's not scary. I mean, it is a good Halloween game, though. Totally it is.
Oh, yeah.
Because you are being chased around a spooky mansion, right?
Yeah. But yeah, it's more funny than anything else.
It's kind of Luigi's Mansion-ish in that way. It's like, yes. It is goofy. And that, which is also kind of the best haunted house game ever. Literally the best.
Yeah, I mean, I think Luigi's Mansion, like, especially if you're of a certain age, I think Luigi's Mansion could actually be a little scary. Which is great, you know. I mean, I think it goes after that. And again, I think if you're just the right audience, or maybe, you know, if you're in exactly the right mindset, you know, Luigi's Mansion does definitely have moments where you walk into a room, you know, there's something in there, but you're not sure where. And you know, it has these kind of shocking sound effects when a ghost pops out, and you know, and your character is relatively slow and weak. And a little bit helpless in that game, and I think it plays around. It's clearly kind of a parody of survival horror, but in its own way, I think it's actually a very effective survival horror game.
I think his reactions actually make it worse because you're momentarily incapacitated by his fear,
mm-hmm.
which means you're now vulnerable, which probably feeds into your own fear.
Exactly,
it increases the powerlessness of his character because he essentially exposes himself to damage.
Yeah.
It's totally. There's some psychological stuff going on in that gameplay model that it's kind of hard to put a finger on sometimes.
There's the scene in the intro to Luigi's Mansion where it's a cutscene, but it zooms in on his hand, his big goofy looking like hamburger helper glove, reaching out to turn that doorknob. but it's like shaking and it's very slow and it's basically first person, you know, like you're seeing it from his perspective and that door slowly opens. And it's very much what was happening with Resident Evil, you know, back in the late 90s, where they would have these drawn out door opening scenes that covered up the load times. But in right. Luigi's Mansion, they used it as a storytelling mechanic, and because they actually showed his hand doing it, and you could kind of hear him as he's doing it. It really actually kind of was more immersive than what Resident Evil was doing at the time. And, right. You know, I think that game deserves a lot of credit. Now, clearly Luigi's Mansion is more of a comedy affair. But I think it has some legitimately scary aspects to it. Or at least it, you know, it kind of points in that direction. If you're willing to go with it, if you're willing to kind of go along with the silliness of it, you know, I think especially for kids, Luigi's Mansion really could be a little bit scary. I don't know about Dark Moon. I mean, on 3DS, it's a little bit harder to convey that sense of, helplessness or immersion.
Portrait ghosts are really kind of the stuff that gets you in there, though, because they're super unsettling sometimes. And they're not in Dark Moon. I mean, like, this whacking generic booze after a while can kind of in. But, like, some of those portrait ghosts, they're super creepy. Like, the first boss, the baby one. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of messed up. You're you're stripping the heart out of an already dead baby.
Yeah.
It's like, this is kind of in a giant crib. this is a little messed up game.
And frankly, that nursery is probably the creepiest place in the whole mansion in the first game. I mean, just because, you know, you've got these things, you know, you've got the toys kind of dangling from the ceiling, and they make noise when they really shouldn't. And there's, you know, a lot of things scattered across the floor that are getting kicked around, and you don't really know what's interactive and what's not, and what's supposed to be moving and what, you know, really shouldn't be. And I think that room is incredibly effective. I think some of the other rooms, like the bathroom, is pretty creepy also. And there's a number of moments that, you know, it's one area where I feel like Dark Moon doesn't quite live up to the original in some of that stuff. Although it probably has better puzzles. Hey, I'm glad we get to talk about Luigi's Mansion. Any excuses is a good one. So why don't we wrap up this little feature? You guys have any final thoughts, any recommendations for people, anything like that, or have we already stretched this thing too thinly?
Pumpkin Zone and Super Mario Land 2. I don't know. I think people know what the horror games are.
Pumpkin Zone in Sonic Adventure 2, because the music will make you break into madness.
Wait, what? There's a Pumpkin Zone in...
Yeah, there is. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It is the worst Sonic song in the history of terrible Sonic songs.
Well, Super Mario Land 2 did it first, and it has little dudes with, like, walking hockey masks with a knife stuck in them walking around. So,
I'll say probably the first time I remember ever being a little creeped out by a first-party Nintendo game was in Mario 64 with that ghost house out in the back.
The piano.
Yeah, there's some, you know, there's some stuff out there, that carousel, that kind of, you know, big spinning room that you get into. There's a number of things where they really use 3D very effectively to kind of disorient you and make things feel a little bit askew. I thought that was great. And then there's the whole haunted house level in Banjo-Kazooie, which again is really more funny and silly than anything. But I think it's a really great early example of a three-dimensional haunted house level in a game. You know, if it weren't for the talking toilet, that whole area might get a little bit more legitimacy. But, and then, you know, we really can't leave out Resident Evil 4, which, you know, I've heard recently some people, I think Patrick Klepek was talking to a guy on the Giant Bomb Interview Dump Truck podcast. They were talking about how Resident Evil 4, you know, even though it's by far the best game in that franchise, it's really not very scary, and that's kind of where the series kind of took a turn towards being more action oriented.
Right.
I got to tell you, I've played Resident Evil 4 a couple of times. I think that game's pretty fucking scary.
I find Remake way scarier with the Crimson Heads.
Resident Evil 4,
you know, like as I've revealed earlier, I'm very reticent to start playing horror games or to keep playing them, but Resident Evil 4 was not a challenge. It was, I think it telegraphed its scares most of the time. So, you know, like once you know what to expect, it's just, you know, why would I be scared of this?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it was the most effective the first time I played it when I didn't know all that stuff was coming out. But I have to say, like, even today, if I go back and play that game, when I hear that chainsaw rev up, that is disturbing. Mm. Like, that really bothers me. And it's like, you know, partly because I know that guy is so dangerous and I really do not want to have to try to fight him because he's really hard to kill. So if I hear that chainsaw, I'm running. I want to get the hell, I would at least want some space in between us so I can deal with the guy a little bit better. But it's just like an instant reaction of like, oh God, no, I want to be out of here. I want to get away, you know? And so I don't want to sell that game short because I think people may, you know, in the fullness of time, maybe they look back and say, you know, there's so much shooting and so much weird storytelling and so much action in Resident Evil 4. It really wasn't that scary. I think that's a little unfair. I mean, it is not consistently scary, but I think there are moments in that game that are pretty intense. You know, that first boss fight when you're in the barn that's on fire, terrifying. I think that whole environment is so stressful, you know, I don't know where I can step and where I can't. I don't know where the guy is. I can't see anything because it's full of smoke and flame. I think that's an incredibly effective scene. It's very creepy.
To me, it's really the chainsaw, but it's actually the chainsaw women, the double,
they're worse.
I was so, you know, because I mean, I had seen all the promotional material. Capcom really played up, dude, Leon can get his head cut off by a chainsaw. Like, they made the stupid GameCube controller.
Controller.
Like, they sort of laid all their cards out before you even got to that guy. But it was like, I heard it, I'm like, wait, that's two chainsaws. Oh shit, what is this? Like, that was kind of when the game was like, oh, too spooky. like everything else in that game, it's not, it's really just killing grotesque monsters. You know, it's not specifically scary. I never found any of the Resident Evil games specifically scary. I found them abhorrent to play. But besides that, like, it's like, oh, there's eight windows in this hall. A dog's going to jump through one of them. Let's see which one it is. Window number one? No. Window number two? No.
Yeah, Remake was my first experience with Resident Evil, and I found it pretty effective. As I said, the Crimson Heads, when they get up the first time, you really don't expect it, and it's just, what the hell? And you really feel like there's danger there. And there was also this weird, I can't remember the names, I don't know my Resident Evil lore, but I think it's Lisa or something, like the deformed girl that's basically invincible, that you find in some sort of cellar. Invincible enemies to me are, you know, usually when they're grotesque or basically the scariest thing that you can put in the game.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a good point. I've never played the remake. I've often thought about it, but never got around to it. All right, guys. Well, we're going to wrap up the show now. Unfortunately, we did not have time to get to listener mail, but we will next week. In fact, we're definitely going to do it next week. We've got some excellent letters already, and you can add to that list with your own questions. You know, we did get some pretty interesting, sort of disturbing financial results from Nintendo this week, and I imagine we're going to be hearing from people about that. But there's a lot to talk about with the new consoles coming out, and of course Nintendo's own fall lineup being a pretty big focus for the company right now. So a lot going on. We'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas and questions about all this stuff. And you can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And of course, I want to thank our friend Michael TYP Cole for jumping in at the last minute and helping us out with new business. And you can always hear him on the Radio Trivia podcast, which is wonderful. It's all about video game music. And although he doesn't yet have a new episode recorded, we're going to try to work on that pretty soon. But he did tell us that we could mention that there will be a live Radio Trivia segment on the telethon this year in late November. And, you know, live is that show started as a live event. It became podcast much later in life. So it works really wonderfully as a live event. It's maybe the best and most pure format for Radio Trivia.
It's certainly the most chaotic.
Yeah, it's exciting. I hope you will look forward to that, and I hope that gives you another good motivation to consider donating to Child's Play as part of the telethon. But we're going to have a lot more details about the telethon coming up probably in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for all of that, and you'll find out all about it over at NintendoWorldReport.com. So thank you, James and Guillaume, and you know, our best thoughts out to Mr. Lindemann, and we'll hope to hear from him again soon. But for now, we are going to bid you adieu, and we'll talk to you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Boo.
Bye.
Well,
there is a trick. I'm not going to look it up right now, but anyone can just look for Castlevania The Adventure Rebirth level select, and it's very easy. It's like hold the direction on the D-pad and select, or something like that. And then you get the choice of starting at levels 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Hello? Okay, I didn't actually understand any of what you just said, but I assume it's a helpful tip.
I said
he actually just said where you can stick it.